Ladies and gentlemen, you are about to witness some scenes from the next attraction to play this theater. This picture, truly one of the most unusual ever filmed, contains scenes which under no circumstances should be viewed by anyone with a heart condition or anyone who is easily upset. We urgently recommend that if you are such a person or the parent of a young or impressionable child now in attendance, that you and the child leave the auditorium for the next 90 seconds.
I'm on a street corner here and they built a house around me while I'm waiting for a cab. So, in the meantime, while I'm biding my time, I'm gonna watch Headless Eyes, New York Sleaze, just the way I like it. So why don't you stick around for the trailer? And after you come back, we'll dissect this son of a bitch.
He called himself a collector. But what he collected meant someone had to die. A maniac is loose. Obsessed by an uncontrollable urge to kill. He's watching you. But when you see him, it will already be too late. Run and he will catch you. Hide and he will find you. When you give him the eye,
he was very pretty.
You're already dead.
Stand back!
And Ashley and I, we just got done seeing Headless Eyes.
Under other circumstances, I just couldn't see it at all.
You can just shut up with that right now. So the movie is, how did I describe it when we were talking before the show? Oh, I remember. Imagine, if you will, take Mosquito the Rapist, an art house film, but it was made by Herschel Gordon Lewis. So this is art house by the way of Grindhouse.
This is very grungy. It's very gritty and grimy in that New York way where there's trash and filth and the decay of the streets everywhere. Just big wide tracking shots, but it's done on the cheap. It's done with lots of people with accents. It's not like an Italian movie where they do the beauty shot of the Empire State Building right off the bat. No, you never see any of those buildings in this. You see skyscrapers, but not recognizable ones.
So, shall we tell them about it then a little bit?
Oh, yes. Basically, this artist who was living with his girlfriend.
Guy's name's Arthur.
Arthur. He was having to pay the rent because she was doing a lot of the bill paying. And so, to supplement his income, he goes and commits burglary. At the wrong place.
But then, as he's busted into the place, the lady who is the resident of the apartment, she wakes up and, oh crap, I'm being attacked, I'm being raped, help, 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 and he jumps her.
Yeah, and she fights back with a spoon, gets it in his eye, and basically impales him, and he kills her in a fit of rage, but with this voiceover in his head, my eye, over and over and over again.
And we should point out that it is not him going, my eyes, and then my eyes, my eyes. It is the same section of audio clipped again and again and again.
And it makes it clear that this possibly is a memory of his from the past in the present day of him screaming my eye, but in his head.
Everybody says, oh, it's just lazy filmmaking. It's just the same section of sound played again and again, and that's just a mistake. They did that on purpose, I'm thinking, because the movie is this character study about Arthur and his descent into madness. And so the movie is from his perspective, and it is his insanity. So the weird audioscape, the discordant music, all of these things come together, and that's part of that.
They play up Arthur as this tortured artist, this guy who casts eyeballs in resin. And this couple comes by and they're looking in the window and they're laughing and they're going, oh, that's weird.
And they're loaded as hell and they kind of make fun of him a little bit in that kind of jovial, drunk person sort of way. But Arthur, he takes it badly. And so he follows them to their house.
And they're having an argument about something. They're getting on each other's nerves. And Arthur just walks up to the door, knocks, and then the wife gets up. And the husband's like, oh, go get it.
I love the dialogue in, like, this scene and generally throughout the movie. It's not super witty dialogue, but it's just kind of this weird, like, the couple's back and forth, go answer the door. It's your apartment, your door, you answer the fucking thing. That sort of thing. I really liked that.
They kind of remind me a little bit of the Lockhorns, if the Lockhorns were slightly younger. The old comic, the Bill Hoist comics.
And a whole lot more New York, because my God, they were so New York.
Oh, Jesus. Yeah, this thing is just dripping over with New Yorkness. So this lady goes and answers the door, and he comes in, and she invites him in. It's like, what the hell? Who would invite a stranger? Well, they recognize him, but they don't know him.
And it's the New York of the 70s, so it's dangerous. That shit's going to get you killed.
Yeah, I mean, this is a guy that could have walked out of a Bernard Melamed novel. I mean, you know, he's kind of just dripping with edge. So he goes in there and hits her over the back of the head with a hammer he's got hidden behind his back. He clocks her, then he clocks the husband or boyfriend. They never say, really, whether they're married. Well, since it's her apartment, I'm guessing they're dating.
It's the other half of the couple. It really doesn't get a lot of clarification, and honestly, it doesn't really need a lot of clarification. Yeah.
And people in here are kind of orbiting each other in a way. I mean, obviously they're connected, but they're not really connecting. They're kind of just there with each other, and he doesn't have anybody. I mean, his relationship dissolved a long time ago, and so he's noticing how people interact, and that's part of what keeps him the God's lonely man, to quote Travis Bickle.
Well, it gets back to his breaking point was the attack and his loss of his eye. That was clearly, he was kind of unhinged to begin with, but obviously that tipped him over the edge. And so, yeah, it's not really.
I mean, he was probably slightly less than normal in that way that a lot of New Yorkers were, the way they described New York in the 70s, where people were kind of in their own little universe, and New York is the jungle, and it's encroaching, and it gets you in, and it gets you here, and it gets you right here, you know, in your little apartment, and you're just like, every next day is like looking out a window. Do I want to go out there today? Nah, fuck that. I'm staying inside where it's safer in here. No, it's safer in here than it's safer in here. You know, and so I can see him struggling with the reality of a situation, and he can't do his art the same way because he doesn't have both eyes, and he needed both eyes to express himself completely, and it's like trying to watch a 3D movie, but you can't because, you know, you only got the flat perception of one frickin' eye.
And so after he does the couple in the apartment, he's walking home, and he runs into a hooker on the street corner. And his hands are all covered in blood, and she's all like, oh my God, you're hurt. Come back to my apartment, and let me take care of you. Let me clean you up. You know, no services required, no fee required. Let me just come help you. So he goes back to the apartment with her and finds out, oh my God, you're a hooker, and that triggers him.
Yeah, he's like, you're filthy and you're tarnished. You must be punished. You must feel my wrath for being so bad and being on the street and being like this filth. You make me feel more filthy being just around you in your little orbit, so I'm going to have to do something about it. It's almost like he's purging sin with every eyeball he takes. He's one level up closer to being resurrected as a new person.
And every time he does it, he apologizes to the victim. I'm sorry, I have to do this. And he also, when he gets caught by the cop at the graveyard, he's like, you cannot stop me. My work is not done. I need to do this. So clearly there is some sort of internal demon purging that he's trying to do through the eyes.
Well, the one jarring thing that I noticed is they actually did a jump forward. There is the next series of victims, basically, is there's a crowd gathered around an apartment, and they say there's been 14 slayings. But then later on, it's 13. And I'm thinking, so is there a jump back in time to when it was 13? Because it kind of made me go, whoa, wait a minute. What's happening here? Was it bad editing or what?
It was probably a little of both. Probably a little bad editing and a little time jumpage. Because there, one scene where they're all gathered on the sidewalk and the reporter is interviewing the crowd and they're bringing out the body of one of the victims. And Arthur is there in the crowd because he wants to watch his handiwork. And then, without any warning, it jumps to a flashback of Arthur committing the crime. And it took me a couple of seconds to realize, wait a minute, what the fuck is going on here? Because it comes out of nowhere and it doesn't really have any context. But then it goes right back to the crowd out front. It's like, okay, I know what's going on. So it might have been bad editing, or it might have been some flashbacks.
It's an interesting movie in the case of where actions and whatnot follow sometimes, but then sometimes they don't. Because obviously, as we were discussing earlier, there were a couple of thematic threads that didn't go anywhere. And I found myself getting dragged deeper and deeper into the murk of this guy's life. So when he goes up and kills this woman on the rooftop, and she sees him, and she instantly goes, oh, this guy's bad. I mean, he's got the eye patch, and he looks kind of stark and everything, and he moves in on her. And this guy just won't quit. I mean, every time he sees a woman, he just goes and moves in on her. Doesn't stop. He's like a fucking freight train that just has no brakes.
He has no self-control, basically.
Yeah, I mean, he doesn't have the filter to realize when he's looking creepy. And if you want to stalk somebody, you don't want to be that obvious unless he was trying to put the fear of him into his victims.
But then everybody in this movie is a little weird because, like, after he leaves the reporters and the crowd gathering watching the guy leave, he's walking along and there's this old lady on a stoop saying, I know who did it. I know who did it. I know who did it. And she's really weird. And there's all sorts of weird, colorful characters sprinkled throughout this whole movie like that.
Yeah, that was interesting. That was one of the most interesting characters in the thing because she reminded me of the Greek chorus in a way. That she's breaking the fourth wall, not directly, but kind of indirectly insinuating she knows who did it. Even though she wasn't there for the murder, she's assuming maybe connecting threads together and drawing in her mind kind of a composite sketch of who the killer is. And he's like, stop it! Shut up! Stop it! She's like, I know who did it! I know who did it! And she has a smile plastered on her face the whole time. I'm thinking, yeah! Holy shit!
The frustrating thing about the movie is that it does have a couple of weird narrative cul-de-sacs. Like, down the road, this art student comes into his art gallery and he's upstairs putting together one of the eyes on ice, and he hears the little ding-a-ling-a-ling from the bell coming in, and he peeks through the curtain and he sees her downstairs looking at one of the pieces saying, this is really nice. It's not an eyepiece. It's just something one of his other sculptures. And he says, this is really awesome. I really like this. You have good quality to your art. You have vision. And he's like, no, I'm not going to come down. And he goes into another trigger flashback. And then he finds a note downstairs later on saying, hey, I really like your stuff. I want to meet you later. So, but she never really pays out at the end.
Yeah, she kind of she disappears. They never kept track of her. But they did go back to this blonde who he tried to trace her whereabouts to where she lives early in the film. And she manages to ditch him. She runs away, gets into a car with this guy, this kind of, you know, New York kind of leather jacket in the dark, kind of sleazy Guido type, and they drive off. And he's kind of left at, you know, dead ends. And basically, this leads into the place where he goes to the cemetery later on to dig up the victim, the gun on the rooftop.
But he was interrupted halfway through getting her eyes, so he has to go complete the task. So he goes, digs her up, digs out her eyes, and that's when the cop, who was in the crowd at the reporter, says, aha, I found you. Which was really weird, because, I mean, he comes out of nowhere, there's no investigation, it's just kind of, I'm here at the graveyard, you're here at the graveyard, I'm busting you.
Well, since it's from our killer's perspective, the assumption is this guy has been keeping tabs on anybody that looks really suspicious in the neighborhood, and maybe that woman told him, I know who did it, maybe he went up to her and said, okay, so who did it? There's this guy, and he's been following him. He's following any lead. He says, yeah, we've got computers trying to track this killer, and we got 2,000 detectives in New York City trying to track him down, and it's just me, blank, blah, blank, doing it the old-fashioned way. So he's a detective who gets in the street, he puts his nose to the ground, he gets out the freaking detective glass, and he takes clues and follows this guy the old-fashioned way.
Unfortunately, we don't see any of that because it's all told from Arthur's point of view. So there may be investigations going on in the background, but from our perspective, from Arthur's perspective, he just shows up out of nowhere. Poof, here I am.
Yeah, and the assumption is, based on the fact that there have been 14 murders, it's been in the paper, people are really edgy, everybody's looking at everybody as a potential killer, so the cops are looking at everybody to see who's reacting what way, you know, and they're following leads. So we know that there's action, and this gives a lot of background to this movie, kind of fills it out, because it means shit's going on, and we're not privy to it, but it's still going on.
After he leaves the art student's date, and he's driving along and he reaches into a pocket and pulls out the address from the blonde that he copied down when he murdered this other secretary. And so he's like, oh wait, I've got this. I'm going to go finish my job. And so he goes, hooks up with her, follows her out of her apartment, and they go into like an industrial down by the docks or something. And he chases her into a meat processing plant. And I loved the ending of this movie. Because, so he goes and kills her, scoops out her eyes, and goes to leave. Goes to the locker door, and he's trapped. Mm-hmm. It's locked behind him. He's now stuck. And we catch, a couple of hours later, a couple of workers come up, open the door. He is frozen. He is dead. He signed his work on the wall. He scrawled his name in blood. Here's my final art display. All right, let's see if you think this is an accurate assessment. This movie, and the ending specifically, is basically an EC comic. In that, okay, so the old EC comics, what would happen is that you would have some sort of bad guy. Like, there was this one I remember where this mad scientist invents a shrinking potion, actually accidentally injects himself with it, and shrinks to microscopic size, and his abused wife accidentally eats him. But that's justice. So the end of the movie where he gets locked in the meat locker and dies trying to commit his crime is a very easy hoist on your own petard sort of ending.
Well, yeah, this is completely let the punishment fit the crime. I mean, he is in this place full of dead meat. After his victims have been killed, there nothing but dead meat for him to dissect. And so he's basically his final masterpiece, you know, rendered in blood and flesh and sin and everything. And he has nowhere to go. And while he's on the way out, he's got a montage of half. It's like these transparent street scene of him being on the sidewalk. It's like it had been superimposed over the wall of him walking on the street.
And there's also, they superimpose, like, really super close-up shots of, like, cows and cow eyes and cow faces. And he is screaming, stop staring at me! Stop staring at me! So it's a little bit of survivor's guilt, a little bit of, you know, the dead are judging you.
And some of the best shots in the movie are when he's running on his own and he's kind of trying to purge himself and the streets are completely empty. It's like you've got this no-budget film, but you've got these big empty streets. They're fucking, it's a wide shot that I would give 1,000, you know, of my firstborn to get a shot like that. This guy in this huge, wide open, empty street that's just him marinating in his own personal hell.
Well, you shoot on Sunday morning, first thing before the crowds get there, and you're going to get a deserted New York. Or at least you could back in the 70s. Nowadays, probably not so much. But back then, that's how you get it done.
Oh, yeah. I mean, this movie is just full of value. I mean, it's got enough people in street scenes when you want them, and then it's got the emptiness of the purgatory this man is basically in, that gray, hard, harsh. This is the mean streets. You know, this is the hard times. This is the real times, you know, when people were just in the shit. You know, and the guys, I mean, I could just see, like, you know, seven words. Fuck this fucking shit. This is shit.
Okay, so the question I have for you then is, a movie where you're dependent on seeing the movie from the killer's perspective. So, Driller Killer, Nightmares on a Damaged Brain, Maniac, that sort of movie. Is they live and die on the compelling nature of the lead. Do you think the lead worked?
Oh, yeah. This guy is completely within his element. I mean, he's every killer I've ever seen in every movie is completely different. That the ones that really stand out. I mean, you have Travis Bickle. The man's obviously psychotic and something of a sociopathic racist. And, you know, he commits what would be considered revenge crimes for people who can't stand up for themselves, but then he goes and tries to commit murder. So he's definitely both kind of the savior at the beginning, kind of like Paul Kersey, you know, the Death Wish thing, but then he turns into a would-be assassin. And then you've got Paul Kersey, you know, the he was a left-leaning kind of liberal guy until his wife got raped and murdered, you know, by Jeff Goldblum and a couple other guys. And then he turns into a gun-toting right-winger who's going to go on a revenge spree, you know, in Death Wish. And those guys came after this one. I mean, this guy is somewhere in the middle of, like, Herschel Gordon Lewis's Blood Feast. And then, you know, Taxi Driver, where you've got somebody committing extraordinary crimes in the most mundane of places. Oh, my God, is that meat locker just so nasty.
Before we started recording, you compared this movie to The Wizard of Gore a little bit.
Yeah. So The Wizard of Gore basically has this guy who hypnotizes an audience into thinking he's performing a mundane sleight of hand trick by killing people, when in reality they're actually being killed. All these women are being mutilated on stage. And then apparently they show up later, and I don't know how the hell he did it, if he have resurrected the dead or something. It's a really weird-ass movie, and I really don't understand what the fuck's going on half the time. But, I mean, he's taking out their their livers and shit like that, and their eyeballs. And they use actual, like, sheep's eyes in that movie. In this one, they're using doll's eyes. But he gets, there's the 70s, kind of late 60s, you know, music, and it's very arch, and he's got the liver, and he's, like, fondling it with his hands. He's smiling, and he's got this greasy makeup and shit on, this big-ass porn mustache. It's just like, oh, my God, he's so greasy and grimy and gets in there. It's Herschel Gordon Lewis at his nastiest best. And this is washed out. This is a really bad print.
The print of this movie was probably stored under somebody's porch with, like, birds and rats shitting all over it, because the print is absolutely atrocious.
It's balls.
But that's probably the best you're ever going to get of this movie. It's much like Andy Gilligan's stuff. It's never going to show up in better.
And if you really want the ultimate just viewing of this movie, view it as is, because this is really the way it needs to be seen. It's cheap, it's tawdry, it's from the hip. It looks like it was shot on reversal stock. Basically, what you shoot is what you get. You can't improve the color of the print, like old Kodak or some shit like that. I mean, this is a movie that deserves to be put back in 42nd Street, along with Driller Killer, along with, you know, any of the other movies that played on in those theaters back in the day, and just rent it as is, because it is, you want to feel filthy and grungy when you crawl out of there on your belly.
So the one thing that everybody is going to rag on this movie, and I think a little bit unfairly because what the movie is trying to do, is the very discordant soundscape and the very atonal music. It's basically just a bunch of clanging and honking and tweeting and very, like, an orchestra exploding, basically.
Yeah, it's like somebody threw a bunch of musical things into a blender and said, hey, there you go. I mean, yeah, as you mentioned before, it's inside this guy's head. When he's chasing the blonde, she gets into a cab and drives off on her way to go dump the coke or the heroin or whatever. He gets in his car and follows, and the music is just this trilling, just in your head. I mean, it was like for several minutes, I was like, ah, fuck.
I know the word you're looking for. Uncomfortable.
Yeah.
Nihilist.
Yeah, there's a lot of nihilism in here. You know, life is shit, let's party. You know, I mean, like, this must be what heroin sounds like when you're on it.
The name has come up a couple of times in the conversation. This movie is, despite coming out 7 or so years before it, this movie is very thematically similar to The Driller Killer and your Nightmares in a Damaged Brain and that sort of movies like that, where it is, yeah, it's just sleazy and just disgusting and grimy and just, you feel like you need to wash after you see this movie.
I will say, I do like the cinematography on this. I mean, obviously, these guys knew what they were doing. I mean, they managed to squeeze a really good picture out of very little money. And they used every street they could get. I mean, it's some of the gorgeous shots in this movie. I mean, these guys were not fucking around here. They made a little mini classic out of this.
So, do you have any final thoughts on Headless Eyes?
If you don't like old, washed-out print movies that you probably would see on Sunday or Saturday afternoon theater, you know, the kind of movies they used to show after church, when you got home after church, you're probably not going to like this kind of sub-Don Doler, you know, Full Moon Entertainment kind of. This is bargain basement's bargain basement here.
All right. It sounds like we can put this episode to bed then, can't we?
I will see you later.
You fucker. Ashley, was Headless Eyes seize worthy? Would you snatch it?
No, this is so primitive and obvious. There's no way anybody could conflate this with reality.
The thing is, I'm going to go the reverse. I'm actually going to put it on the seizable list because it's inherently just so grimy and sleazy and uncomfortable. And it is not very graphic, but it does have a lot of blood to it.
Yeah, I mean, it just seemed to me really mild. It reminded me of the stuff they would not run uncut on TV, but you could get in the old days on video without having to be, you know, 17 to watch it. You could just walk in and check this one out.
It's very harmless. I will admit that. As far as sin goes, if Texas Chainsaw is up here, this would be way down in the basement. But I would still put it on the list.
Well, I guess the relentless nature of it and the intent of it kind of wins out over the graphic content in a way. So, I mean, even if it's not really nasty, in the case of the special effects, it's nasty just because it's on and on and on and on at you.
Exactly. That's it exactly. So, all right. I'd grab it. You would not.
All right.
All right. Did you like Headless Eyes?
I liked it. I mean, I didn't love it, but I didn't hate it. I liked it in the kind of a little more than tepid way.
I think that I would put it in the same category that I liked it, but I like it with a big asterisk in that, much like The Driller Killer, I enjoyed it. I can watch it for its technical merit, but I would not watch this for pleasure. I don't see myself watching this again.
As far as the subject matter goes, I mean, yeah, it's really spare in what it does, but it does it really well.
How about this? I would recommend it, but with a warning label. That not necessarily that it's violent content or anything. Warning label that your mileage may vary.
I would say people should, if they like this kind of movies, they should watch it at least once to find out whether it's for them.
So, we like it with an asterisk.
Yeah, caveat emptor.
And we'll catch you next week. Keep an eye out for us.
Ooh.
Yes, there's an air about hot coffee that's hard to resist. Full-bodied, refreshing hot coffee makes any time a pleasant interlude. Won't you have some now?
Hey guys, we just dissected Headless Eyes. Oh my God, that was sick. Just the way I like it. Well, next week, we've got Hell Prison, Women in Prison Picture. I think you'll like it. So if you like what you've seen here tonight, why don't you fire us off an email at thevideonastyproject@gmail.com. And remember, stay evil.
Shh, there's somebody at the door. Go answer it.
Why don't you?
Well, you're always throwing up to my face that it's your house, so it must be your door. Go answer it.
Aren't you cute?
Well, I try.